Later that same year, a guy named Paul Coleman joined Bridgewater. We had become good friends from our dealings in the cattle and beef industry, and I respected his intellect and values, so I convinced him we should conquer the world together. He brought his wonderful wife and kids up from Guymon, Oklahoma, and our families became inseparable. We ran the business in a scrappy seat-of-the-pants sort of way. Because the office part of the brownstone where I lived and worked was generally such a mess with chicken bones or other scraps from working through the previous night's dinner littering my desk, we held our client meetings at the Harvard Club. Paul would hide a clean blue Oxford shirt and tie amid the mess so I'd have something to wear. In 1981, we decided we wanted to raise our families in more of a country setting, so we moved to Wilton, Connecticut, to run Bridgewater from there. Coleman and I worked by challenging each other's ideas and trying to find the best answers. It was a constant back and forth, which we both enjoyed, especially at a time when there was so much to figure out. We would debate about the markets and the forces behind them late into the night, plug data into the computer before we went to bed, and see what it would spit out in the morning. My big depression call. The economy was in even worse shape in 1979-81 than it was during the financial crisis of 2007-08, and the markets were more volatile. In fact, some would say that this was the most volatile period ever. It was one of the most pivotal times in the last 100 years. The political pendulum throughout the world swung to the right, bringing Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and Helmut Kohl to power. Liberal had ceased to mean being in favor of progress and had come to mean paying people not to work. As I saw it, the Fed was stuck between a rock and a hard place. They either had to print money to relieve the debt problems and keep the economy going, which had already pushed inflation to 10% in 1981 and was causing people to dump bonds and buy inflation hedge assets. Or they had to break the back of inflation by becoming bone-crushing tight, which would break the back of debtors because debt was the highest level since the Great Depression. The worsening problem showed up in progressively higher levels of inflation and progressively worse levels of economic activity. Both appeared to be coming to a head. Debts continued to rise much faster than the incomes borrowers needed to repay them. And American banks were lending huge amounts, much more than they had in capital, to emerging countries. In March of 1981, I wrote a daily observation entitled "The Next Depression in Perspective," and concluded it by saying, "The enormity of our debt implies that the depression will be as bad or worse than we witnessed in the 1930s. This view was extremely controversial. To most people, depression was a scary word used by kooky, sensationalist people, not something thoughtful people took seriously. But I had studied debt and depressions back to 1800, done my calculations, and was confident that the debt crisis, led by emerging countries, was coming. I had to share my thinking with my clients. Because my views were so controversial, I asked others to track my reasoning and point out to me where it was bad. No one could find any flaws in my logic, though they were all reluctant to endorse my conclusion. Because I believed that the choice was between accelerating inflation and deflationary depression, I was holding both gold, which performs well in accelerating inflation, and bonds, which perform well in deflationary depressions. Up until that point, gold and bonds moved in opposite directions, depending on whether inflation expectations rose or fell. Holding these positions seemed much safer than holding alternatives like cash, which would lose value in an inflation environment, or stocks, which would crash in a depression. At first, the markets went against me, but my experience with silver and other trades had taught me that I had a chronic problem with timing, so I believed that I was just early and what I was expecting would happen soon. That didn't take long to happen. By the fall of 1981, the tight Fed policies were having a devastating effect. My bond bets were beginning to pay off, and my kooky views were starting to look right on. In February 1982, the Fed temporarily added liquidity to avoid a cash crunch. In June, as the scramble for liquidity intensified, the Fed responded by printing money, increasing liquidity to its highest level since Paul Volcker's appointment. But it still wasn't enough. The greatest whipsaw ever. In 1982, Mexico defaulted on its debt. By then, it was clear to most everyone that a number of other countries were about to follow. This was a huge deal because U.S. banks had lent about 250% of their capital to other countries just as at risk as Mexico. Business loan activity in the U.S. ground to a halt. Because I was one of the few people who had seen these things coming, I started to get a lot of attention. Congress was holding hearings on the crisis and invited me to testify. In November, I was featured on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, the must-watch show for anyone in the markets. In both appearances, I confidently declared that we were headed for depression and explained why. After Mexico's default, the Fed responded to the economic collapse and debt defaults by making money more readily available. This caused the stock market to jump by a record amount. While that surprised me, I interpreted it as a knee-jerk reaction to the Fed's move. After all, in 1929, a 15% rally was followed by the greatest crash of all time. In October, I laid out my prognosis in a memo. As I saw it, there was a 75% chance the Fed's efforts would fall short and the economy would move into failure, a 20% chance it would initially succeed at stimulating the economy but still ultimately fail, and a 5% chance it would provide enough stimulus to save the economy but trigger hyperinflation. To hedge against the worst possibilities, I bought gold and Treasury bill futures as a spread against Eurodollar futures, which was a limited-risk way of betting on credit problems increasing. I was dead wrong. After a delay, the economy responded to the Fed's efforts, rebounding in a non-inflationary way. In other words, inflation fell while growth accelerated. The stock market began a big bull run, and over the next 18 years, the U.S. economy enjoyed the greatest non-inflationary growth period in history. How was that possible? Eventually, I figured it out. As money poured out of these borrower countries and into the U.S., it changed everything. It drove the dollar up, which produced deflationary pressures in the U.S., which allowed the Fed to ease interest rates without raising inflation. This fueled a boom. The banks were protected both because the Federal Reserve loaned them cash and the creditors' committees and international financial restructuring organizations, such as the International Monetary Fund and the Bank for International Settlements, arranged things so that the debtor nations could pay their debt service from new loans. That way, everyone could pretend everything was fine and write down those loans over many years. My experience over this period was like a series of blows to the head with a baseball bat. Being so wrong, and especially so publicly wrong, was incredibly humbling and cost me just about everything I had built at Bridgewater. I saw that I had been an arrogant jerk who was totally confident in a totally incorrect view. So there I was, after 8 years in business, with nothing to show for it. Though I'd been right much more than I'd been wrong, I was all the way back to square one. At one point, I'd lost so much money I couldn't afford to pay the people who worked for me. One by one, I had to let them go. We went down to two employees, Coleman and me. Then Coleman had to go. With tears from it all, his family packed up and returned to Oklahoma. Bridgewater was now down to just one employee, me. Losing people I cared so much about, and very nearly losing my dream of working for myself, was devastating. To make ends meet, I even had to borrow $4,000 from my dad until we could sell our second car. I had come to a fork in the road. Should I put on a tie and take a job on Wall Street? That was not the life I wanted. On the other hand, I had a wife and two young children to support. I realized I was facing one of life's big turning points, and my choices would have big implications for me and for my family's future. Finding a way past my intractable investment problem. Making money in the markets is tough. The brilliant trader and investor Bernard Baruch put it well when he said, "If you are ready to give up everything else and study the whole history and background of the market and all principal companies whose stocks are on the board as carefully as a medical student studies anatomy, if you can do all that, and in addition, you have the cool nerves of a gambler, the sixth sense of a clairvoyant, and the courage of a lion, you have a ghost of a chance." In retrospect, the mistakes that led to my crash seemed embarrassingly obvious. First, I had been wildly overconfident and let my emotions get the better of me. I learned, again, that no matter how much I knew and how hard I worked, I could never be certain enough to proclaim things like I had on Wall Street Week. There would be no soft landing. I could say with absolute certainty, because I know how markets work. I am still shocked and embarrassed at how arrogant I was. Second, I saw the value of studying history. What had happened, after all, was another one of those. I should have realized that debts denominated in one's own currency can be successfully restructured with the help of the government, and that when central banks simultaneously provide stimulus, as they did in March 1932 at the low point of the Depression, and they did again in 1982, inflation and deflation can be balanced against each other. As in 1971, I had failed to recognize the lessons of history. Realizing that made me try to make sense of all movements in all major economies and markets going back 100 years, and to come up with carefully tested decision-making principles that are timeless and universal. Third, I was reminded how difficult it is to time markets. My long-term estimates of equilibrium levels were not reliable enough to bet on. Too many things could happen between the time I placed my bets and the time, if ever, that my estimates were reached. Staring at these failures, I realized that if I was going to move forward without a high likelihood of getting whacked again, I would have to look at myself objectively and change, starting by learning a better way of handling the natural aggressiveness I've always shown in going after what I wanted. Imagine that, in order to have a great life, you have to cross a dangerous jungle. You can stay safe where you are and have an ordinary life, or you can risk crossing the jungle to have a terrific life. How would you approach that choice? Take a moment to think about it, because it's the sort of choice that in one way or another we all have to make. Even after my crash, I knew that I had to go after the terrific life with all of its risk. So the question was, how to cross the dangerous jungle without getting killed? In retrospect, my crash was one of the best things that ever happened to me because it gave me the humility I needed to balance with my aggressiveness. I learned a great fear of being wrong that shifted my mindset from thinking, I'm right, to asking myself, how do I know I'm right? And I saw clearly that the best way to answer this question is by finding other independent thinkers who are on the same mission as me and who see things differently from me. By engaging them in thoughtful disagreement, I'd be able to understand their reasoning and have them stress test mine. That way we can raise all of our probabilities of being right. In other words, I just wanted to be right. I didn't care if the answers came from me. So I learned to be radically open-minded to allow others to point out what I might be missing. I saw that the only way I could succeed was, one, seek out the smartest people who disagreed with me so I could try to understand their reasoning. Two, know when not to have an opinion. Three, develop, test, and systemize timeless and universal principles. And four, balance risks in ways that keep the big upside while reducing the downside. Doing these things significantly improved my returns relative to my risks. And the same principles apply in other aspects of life. Most importantly, it led me to build Bridgewater as an idea meritocracy, not an autocracy in which I would lead and others would follow, and not a democracy in which everyone's vote is equal, but a meritocracy that encourages thoughtful disagreements and explores and weighs people's opinions in proportion to their merits. Bringing these opposing opinions into the open and exploring them taught me a lot about how people think. I came to see that people's greatest weaknesses are the flip sides of their greatest strengths. For example, some people are prone to take on too much risk, while others are too risk-averse. Some are too focused on the details, while others are too focused on the big picture. Most are too much one way and not enough the other. Typically, by doing what comes naturally to us, we fail to account for our weaknesses, which leads us to crash. What happens after we crash is most important. Successful people change in ways that allow them to continue to take advantage of their strengths while compensating for their weaknesses. And unsuccessful people don't do that. Later in this audiobook, I will describe specific strategies for change. But the important thing to note here is that beneficial change begins when you can acknowledge and even embrace your weaknesses. Over the years that followed, I found that most of the extraordinarily successful people I met had similar big painful failures that taught them the lessons that ultimately helped them to succeed. Looking back on getting fired from Apple in 1985, Steve Jobs said, "It was awful tasting medicine, but I guess the patient needed it. Sometimes life hits you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did." That's Steve Jobs. I saw that to do exceptionally well, you have to push your limits, and that if you push your limits, you will crash, and it will hurt a lot. You will think you have failed, but that won't be true unless you give up. Believe it or not, your pain will fade, and you will have many other opportunities ahead of you, though you might not see them at the time. The most important thing you can do is gather the lessons these failures provide and gain humility and radical open-mindedness in order to increase your chances of success. Then you press on. My final lesson was perhaps the most important one, because it applied again and again throughout my life. At first, it seemed to me that I faced an all-or-nothing choice. I could either take a lot of risk in pursuing high returns and occasionally find myself ruined, or I could lower my risk and settle for lower returns. But I needed to have both low risk and high returns, and by setting out on a mission to discover how I could, I learned to go slowly when faced with the choice between two things that you need and that are seemingly at odds. That way you can figure out how to have as much of both as possible. There is almost always a good path that you just haven't discovered yet. So you have to look for it until you find it, rather than settle for the choice that is then apparent to you. As difficult as this was, I eventually found a way to have my cake and eat it too. I call it the Holy Grail of investing, and it's the secret behind Bridgewater's success. Chapter 4, My Road of Trials, 1983 to 1994. Coming out of my crash, I was so broke I couldn't muster enough money to pay for an airline ticket to Texas to visit a prospective client, even though the fees I'd earned were many times the cost of the fare, so I didn't make the trip. Still, I gradually added clients, revenue, and a new team. With time, my upswings increased in magnitude and my downswings were both tolerable and educational. I never thought of what I was doing as building or rebuilding a company. I was just getting the things I needed to play my game. Computers were among the most valuable things I acquired because of how they helped me think. Without them, Bridgewater would not have been nearly as successful as it turned out to be. The first microcomputers, what would later be known as personal computers, had come on the market during the late 1970s, and I'd been using them as econometricians did, applying statistics and computing power to economic data to analyze the workings of the economic machine. As I wrote in a December 1981 article, I believed, and I still believe, that theoretically, if there were a computer that could hold all of the world's facts, and if it was perfectly programmed to mathematically express all the relationships between all of the world's parts, the future would be perfectly foretold. But I was a long way from doing that. Though my early systems provided valuable insights into where prices would eventually reach equilibrium, they hadn't helped me develop robust trading strategies. They just showed me that a particular bet would eventually pay off. For example, I'd run through my analysis and end up with a review of the price of some commodities should be, say, 75 cents or so. If it was currently 60 cents, I'd know that I'd want to buy it, but I wouldn't be able to predict that the price would drop to 50 cents before climbing back to 75 cents, and I wouldn't know when to buy and sell. Rarely, but still too often, the system would be dead wrong and I would lose a lot. He who lives by the crystal ball is destined to eat ground glass is a saying I quoted a lot in those days. Between 1979 and 1982, I had eaten enough glass to realize that what was most important wasn't knowing the future. It was knowing how to react appropriately to the information available at each point in time. In order to do that, I would have to have a vast store of economic and market data to draw on. And as it happened, I did. From very early on, whenever I took a position in the markets, I wrote down the criteria I used to make my decision. Then, when I closed out a trade, I could reflect on how well these criteria worked. It occurred to me that if I wrote those criteria into formulas, now more fashionably called algorithms, and then ran historical data through them, I could test how well my rules would have worked in the past. Here's how it worked in practice. I would start out with my intuitions, as I always did, but I would express them logically as decision-making criteria and capture them in a systematic way, creating a mental map of what I would do in each particular situation. Then I would run historical data through the systems to see how my decision would have performed in the past, and depending on the results, modify the decision rules appropriately. We tested the systems going back as far as we could, typically more than a century, in every country in which we had data, which gave me great perspective on how the economic market machine worked through time and how to bet on it. Doing this helped me create and led me to refine my criteria so they were timeless and universal. Once I vetted those relationships, I could run data through the systems as it flowed at us in real time, and the computer could work just as my brain worked in processing it and making decisions. The result was Bridgewater's original interest rate, stock, currencies, and precious metal systems, which we then combined into one system for managing our portfolio's bets. Our system was like an EKG on the economy's vital signs. As they changed, we changed our positions. However, rather than blindly following the computer's recommendations, I would have the computer work in parallel with my own analysis and then compare the two. When the computer's decision was different from mine, I would examine why. Most of the time, it was because I had overlooked something. In those cases, the computer taught me. But sometimes I would think about some new criteria my system would have missed, so I would then teach the computer. We helped each other. It didn't take long before the computer, with its tremendous processing power, was much more effective than me. This was great because it was like having a chess grandmaster helping me plot my moves, except this player operated according to a set of criteria that I understood and believed were logical, so there was no reason for us to ever fundamentally disagree. The computer was much better than my brain in, quote, thinking about many things at once, and it could do it more precisely, more rapidly, and less emotionally. And because it had such a great memory, it could do a better job of compounding my knowledge and the knowledge of the people I worked with as Bridgewater grew. Rather than argue about our conclusions, my partners and I would argue about our different decision-making criteria. Then we resolved our disagreements by testing the criteria objectively. The rapidly expanding power of computers during the era was like a constant stream of gifts from the gods to us. I remember when Radio Shack came out with an inexpensive handheld chess computer. We sent one to each of our clients with a message and a little sign on it that said, "A systemized approach from Bridgewater." That little computer chess game could kick my ass on level 2 out of its 9 levels. It was fun to put it up against my clients so that they could see how hard it was to beat computerized decision-making. Of course, we always had the freedom to override the system, which we did less than 2% of the time, mostly to take money off the table during extraordinary events that weren't programmed, like the World Trade Center going down on 9/11. While the computer was much better than our brains in many ways, it didn't have the imagination, understanding, and logic that we did. That's why our brains working with the computer made such a great partnership. These decision-making systems were much better than the forecasting systems that I'd been using before, mostly because they incorporated our ongoing reactions to developments, allowing us to deal with a wider range of possibilities. They could also include timing rules. In a January 1987 piece called Making Money Versus Making Forecasts, I explained that, the truth be known, forecasts aren't worth very much, and most people who make them don't make money in the markets. That's because nothing is certain, and when one overlays the probabilities of all the various things that affect the future in order to make a forecast, one gets a wide array of possibilities with varying probabilities, not one highly probable outcome. We believe that market movements reflect economic movements. Economic movements are reflected in economic statistics. By studying the relationships between economic statistics and market movements, we've developed precise rules for identifying important shifts in economic market environments, and in turn our positions. In other words, rather than forecasting changes in the economic environment and shifting positions in anticipation of them, we pick up these changes as they are occurring and move our money around to keep in those markets which perform best in that environment. Over the last three decades of building these systems, we have incorporated many more types of rules that direct every aspect of our trading. Now, as real-time data is released, our computers parse information from over 100 million data sets and give detailed instructions to other computers in ways that make logical sense to me. If I didn't have these systems, I'd probably be broke or dead from the stress of trying so hard. We certainly wouldn't have done as well in the markets as we've done. As you will see later, I am now developing similar systems to help make management decisions. I believe one of the most valuable things you can do to improve your decision-making is to think through your principles for making decisions. Write them down in both words and computer algorithms. Backtest them if possible, and use them on a real-time basis to run in parallel with your brain's decision-making. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to 1983. Resurrecting Bridgewater. By late 1983, Bridgewater had 6 employees. Up until then, I hadn't done any marketing. The business we got came in from word of mouth and from people reading my daily telexes and seeing my public appearances. But clearly, there was a growing demand for our research, and I realized we could sell it to supplement our consulting and trading income. So I hired a 7th employee, a former door-to-door Bible salesman named Rob Freed, and we hit the road lugging around a projector, a huge stack of slides, hawking a $3,000 per month research package with my daily telexes, weekly conference calls, bi-weekly and quarterly research reports, and quarterly meetings. Over the next year, Rob brought in a number of institutional clients and institutional investment managers, including General Electric, Keystone Custodian Funds, the World Bank, Brandywine, Loomis Sales, Provident Capital Management, the Singer Company, Lowe's Corporation, GTE, and Wellington Management. At that point, our business consisted of 3 main areas: consulting for fees, managing companies' risks for incentive fees, and selling the research packages. We worked with all sorts of corporate, financial, and government institutions that had market exposures: banks, diversified international businesses, commodities producers, food producers, public utilities, and more. For example, we built a plan to help a multinational company deal with the currency exposure it faced from operating in different countries. My approach was to immerse myself in a business until I got to the point where I felt that the strategies I was handing off were the ones I would use if I were running the company. I would break each company down into its distinct logical components and then come up with a plan for managing each part using a variety of financial tools, especially derivative instruments. The most important components to separate were the profits coming from the core business and those that were speculative profits and losses coming from price changes. We would do this to show them what a risk-neutral position would look like, which is to say, the properly hedged position one would take if one didn't have a view of the markets. I would advise them to deviate from that position only when they wanted to speculate, which they should only do in measured ways and with the full knowledge of the effects it could have on their core business. This approach was eye-opening to most of the firms that we worked with. It gave them clarity and control and yielded them better results. Sometimes they wanted us to speculate for them, which we would do for a share of the profits. This approach to establishing a risk-neutral benchmark and deviating from it with measured bets was the genesis of the style of investment management we would later call alpha overlay, in which passive bets, in other words beta, and active, in other words alpha, exposures were separated. The return of a market, such as the stock market itself, is called its beta. Alpha is the return that comes from betting against others. For example, some people outperform the stock market and other people underperform it. They are said to have positive or negative alpha. With alpha overlay, we were offering a way of making bets independent of underlying market performance. Approaching the market in this way taught me that one of the keys to being a successful investor is to only take bets you are highly confident in and then to diversify them. One of our clients in the mid-1980s was Alan Bond, an audacious entrepreneur who was one of the richest people in Australia. A self-made man, he was famous for being the first non-American to win the America's Cup race in its 132-year history. Like Bunker Hunt, he eventually bet badly and was forced to declare bankruptcy. I advised him and his team on their way up and stayed on through his downfall, so I watched the tragedy unfold from up close. His was a classic case of confusing business with speculation and only hedging when it was too late. Bond borrowed U.S. dollars to buy assets like breweries in Australia. He did that because U.S. interest rates were lower than they were in Australia. Though he didn't realize it, he was speculating that the U.S. dollar, in which he would have to pay back his loans, would not rise. When the U.S. dollar did rise against the Australian dollar in the mid-1980s, and his Australian dollar beer sales earnings weren't enough to pay his debts, his team called me for advice. I calculated what Bond Corp's position would be if they hedged on currencies, and I saw that doing so would lock in losses that would ruin them, so I advised them to wait. When the Australian dollar rallied, I advised them to put on the hedges, but they didn't because they believed the currency problem had gone away. Before long, the Australian dollar plunged to new lows, and they called me in for an emergency meeting. There wasn't much they could do without locking in ruinous losses, so again they did nothing, and this time the dollar didn't rally. Seeing one of the richest and most accomplished men on the planet lose everything made a huge impression on me. We also did one-off consulting projects related to the markets. In 1985, I worked with Paul Tudor Jones, a good friend of mine and a great trader, to design a U.S. dollar futures contract. In other words, a tradable index tracking the price of the U.S. dollar against the basket of foreign currencies. And it traded, and still trades, on the New York Cotton Exchange. I also worked with the New York Futures Exchange to help design and market their CRB, that stands for Commodity Research Bureau, futures contract, which was a tradable index that tracks the price of a basket of commodities. Unlike most people who work in the markets, I never had any desire to build investment products, especially conventional ones, just because they would sell well. All I wanted to do was trade the markets and build relationships, doing for clients exactly what I would do if I were in their shoes. But I also loved building brand new things, especially if they were great and revolutionary. By the mid-1980s, a couple of things were clear to me. First, we were making good calls in the interest rate and currency markets, and the institutional investment managers who were buying our research were using them to make money. Second, we were successfully managing companies' interest rate and currency exposures. With those two things going as well as they were, I figured we could become successful institutional investment managers ourselves. So I made the pitch to the people who ran the World Bank's pension fund, most importantly Hilda Ochoa, who was its chief investment officer at the time. Despite the fact that we had no assets under management and no track record, she gave us a $5 million U.S. bond account to manage. That was a huge turning point for us, as it was the start of Bridgewater as we know it today. The strategy we used for the World Bank shifted between holding cash and holding 20-year U.S. Treasury bonds because these positions would give us leveraged bets on the direction of interest rates. When our systems indicated that the pressure on interest rates would cause them to fall, we would hold 20-year Treasury bonds, and when the system pointed to rates rising, we would stay in cash. We did very well, and before long, other large institutional investors gave us money to manage as well. Mobil Oil and Singer were our next two accounts, and others followed in rapid succession. We went on to become the top-performing U.S. bond manager in the world. Venturing behind the closed door of China. Part of what was great about consulting was that it gave me opportunities to travel. The more unusual a place, the more interesting I found it. This curiosity drew me to Beijing in 1984. The only images I'd seen of China when I was growing up were of masses of people waving Mao's little red book. So having an opportunity to go behind what was still a mostly closed door was alluring. I got the invitation because I had set up a small office in Hong Kong, whose director was an advisor to CITIC, the window company, that was the only business in China allowed to deal with people in the outside world. Beijing was filled with wonderful and incredibly hospitable people who introduced us to the tradition of drinking shots of Mao Tai while shouting Gombei, which is bottoms up, and generally showed us a great time. The first trip, which I made with my wife and a few other people, began an incredibly rewarding 30-plus year journey that had a profound impact on my family and me. There were no financial markets in China at the time. Eventually, a small group put together of seven Chinese companies, including CITIC, known as the Securities Executive Education Council, began to develop them. They started in 1989, just before the Tiananmen Square incident, which set them back because such market developments were still seen as too capitalist. They operated out of a small hotel room and hardly had any financing. I can still picture the big garbage bin under the metal stairway going up to their office. I really respected the risks that these young people were taking by doing this at such an unsettled time. So I made a small donation to give them a hand and was excited to share my knowledge with them. From nothing, these people built China's markets and the government security regulatory arm. In 1994, I set up a small company called Bridgewater China Partners. By then, I was convinced that China was poised to become the greatest economy in the world in the 21st century. But hardly anyone was investing in China yet. Good deals could be struck. I could bring money to the table by introducing my institutional investment clients to opportunities, and I could provide know-how by introducing Chinese companies to American ones. In exchange, we would get a stake in these companies. Essentially, I was setting up the first U.S.-based private equity firm in China. I launched the company by bringing a small group of institutional investor clients who together managed $70 billion in assets to China for a visit, When we got back, we agreed to move forward by setting up a jointly owned merchant bank in Beijing. While I knew that entering a territory where few had been before would require a lot of experimentation and learning, I soon realized that I had sorely underestimated the complexity of the task we had set for ourselves and the amount of time it would take. I found myself constantly on the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to make sense of the shaky accounting and questionable controls at the companies we were interested in. With all of my Bridgewater responsibilities awaiting me when the sun came up. After about a year of this, I could see that running both Bridgewater and Bridgewater China Partners wasn't going to be possible, so I closed its doors. Nobody made or lost any money because I hadn't been comfortable enough with what I was seeing to make any investments. I'm sure that if I had devoted all my time to it, we would have had great success, but then Bridgewater would not have been what it is today. Despite passing up this great opportunity, I don't regret my choice. I learned that if you work hard and creatively, you can have just about anything you want, but you can't have everything you want. Maturity is the ability to reject good alternatives in order to pursue even better ones. While I stepped away from that opportunity, China remained an important part of my own and my family's lives. We loved it, especially the people. In 1995, my wife Barbara, our 11-year-old son Matt, and I decided together that Matt would spend a year in Beijing, attending an all-Chinese school and living with our friend Madame Gu, who stayed with us in America during the Tiananmen Square days, and who Matt had visited in China with us when he was 3. Standards of living in China were very different from what Matt was accustomed to in Connecticut. For example, the apartment Madame Gu and her husband lived in had hot water for showers only twice a week, and the school Matt attended didn't have heat until well into the winter, so the students wore their coats in the classrooms. Matt didn't speak Chinese, and none of his classmates spoke English. All of this was not just a huge adventure for Matt. It was completely unprecedented and required special permission from the Chinese government. I was excited for Matt because I knew he would see a different world and broaden his mind. Barbara needed a little convincing and a couple of visits to a child psychologist for reassurance. But she had lived all around the world herself and knew how it had benefited her, so she was ultimately receptive to the idea, even if she was less excited about being separated from her son. Matt's difficult but life-changing journey profoundly affected his values and goals. Because he fell in love with China, he says he became a bit Chinese that year. And because he learned the value of empathy relative to the value of material wealth, he started a charity called China Care to help Chinese special needs orphans when he was just 16. He ran it for 12 years, and to a much lesser degree still does, while shifting his efforts to reconceive what computing can be in the emerging world, which he is executing through his company Endless. I, in turn, learned a lot from Matt, especially about the joys of philanthropy, and we both learned the deep pleasures of great personal relationships. Over the years, I, and in turn Bridgewater, have also built meaningful relationships with many wonderful people in China and have helped its financial institutions grow from fledgling organizations to sophisticated giants. China wasn't the only country whose people and governments Bridgewater would become involved with. Through their representatives, the government investment funds of Singapore, Abu Dhabi, and Australia, as well as Russian and European policymakers, came knocking at our door. The experiences I've had, the perspectives I've gained, and the help I was able to provide all added up to a package of rewards as large as any others that I'd gotten out of my career. My contact with Singapore's people and institutions also thrilled me. There was, and still is, no leader I admire more than Lee Kuan Yew, who transformed Singapore from a mosquito-infested backwater to a model economy. That says a lot, as I've gotten to know and admire several world leaders. One of my most thrilling moments was a dinner I had with him at my house in New York shortly before his death in 2015. Lee requested the dinner to discuss the state of the world economy. I invited former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, another hero of mine, former Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, whose breadth of experiences gave great perspective, and Charlie Rose, one of the most curious and insightful people I know. Besides answering his questions, we probed Lee on world affairs and world leaders. Since he has personally known virtually all of the world's leaders over the last 50 years, we asked Lee about the qualities that distinguish the great ones from the bad ones, and what he thought about those who were leading at the time. He rated Angela Merkel as the best leader in the West, and considered Vladimir Putin one of the best leaders worldwide. He explained that leaders must be judged within the circumstances they encounter, and then went on to share his view of how difficult it is to lead Russia and why he thought Putin was doing it well. He also reflected on his unique relationship with Deng Xiaoping, whom he regarded as the best leader of all. I love getting to know interesting people from interesting places and seeing the world through their eyes. This is true whether they are rich or poor. Seeing life through the eyes of the indigenous people I got to know in Papua New Guinea was as illuminating for me as gaining the perspectives of political and economic leaders, world-changing entrepreneurs, and cutting-edge scientists that I've spent time with. I'll never forget the blind man I met in a mosque in Syria who explained the Quran and his connection to God to me. Encounters like these have taught me that human greatness and terribleness are not correlated with wealth or other conventional measures of success. I've also learned that judging people before really seeing things through their eyes stands in the way of understanding their circumstances, and it isn't smart. I urge you to be curious enough to want to understand how the people who see things differently from you came to see them that way. You will find that interesting and invaluable, and the richer perspective you gain will help you decide what you should do. My family and my extended family. My family, my extended family of co-workers, and my work have all been extremely important to me. Juggling work and family has been as much a challenge to me as anyone else, especially since I wanted both to be great, so I combined them whenever I could. For example, I took my kids on business trips. When I first brought my son Devin and later Matt to my Chinese business meetings, our hosts were always very kind. For example, they would give them cookies and milk. One great memory from Abu Dhabi was when my clients and friends took my son Paul and me to the desert to eat freshly killed and roasted goat with our bare hands. I asked Paul, who was dressed in the traditional gown that they'd given him, how he liked it, and he said, "What could be better than to sit on the floor dressed in pajamas eating with my hands with nice people?" We all laughed. I remember another time when my eldest son, Devin, then about 10 years old, brought back silk scarves from China he bought for about $1 each and sold for $20 each in a shopping mall just before Christmas, which was just the first sign of his business savvy. By the mid-1980s, Bridgewater had grown to about 10 people, so I rented a big old farmhouse. Bridgewater occupied part of it, and my family occupied the rest. It was extremely informal and family-like. Everyone parked in the driveway, we met around the kitchen table, and my kids would leave the door open while they sat on the toilet, and the people I worked with would wave as they walked by. Eventually, the farm was put up for sale, so I bought a barn on the property and renovated it. My wife, our kids, eventually there were four, and I lived in a small apartment inside the barn, and I made the unfinished hayloft usable as an office by putting in electric baseboard heat, which I chose because it was the cheapest to install. It was a great space for parties, and there was enough land for us to play soccer and volleyball and have outdoor barbecues. For our company Christmas party, we'd have a big potluck dinner with my family. After a few drinks, Santa would show up and we would all sit on his lap for a photo and find out who'd been naughty and nice. The night always ended with a lot of dancing. We also had an annual sleaze day when everyone would dress up sleazy. You get the idea. Bridgewater was a small community of friends who worked hard and partied hard. Bob Prince joined Bridgewater in 1986 when he was still in his 20s, and over 30 years later, we are still close partners as well as chief investment officers. From the start, Bob and I played great jazz together whenever we'd go back and forth on ideas. We still love doing that, and we'll do that until one of us dies. He is also a great teacher, both to clients and coworkers. Over time, he became like my brother, as well as one of the most critical builders and pillars of Bridgewater. Soon, Bridgewater began to look like a real company. We outgrew the barn and moved into a small office in a strip mall. There were 20 of us by the end of the 1980s. But even as we grew, I never thought of anybody I worked with as an employee. I always wanted to have and be around people who also wanted to have a life full of meaningful work and meaningful relationships. And to me, a meaningful relationship is one that's open and honest in a way that lets people be straight with each other. I never valued more traditional, antiseptic relationships where people put on a facade of politeness and don't say what they really think. I believe that all organizations basically have two types of people. Those who work to be part of a mission and those who work for a paycheck. I wanted to surround myself with people who needed what I needed, which was to make sense of things for myself. I spoke frankly, and I expected those around me to speak frankly. I fought for what I thought was best, and I wanted them to do that as well. When I thought someone did something stupid, I said so, and I expected them to tell me when I did something stupid. Each of us would be better for it. To me, that's what strong and productive relationships look like. Operating any other way would be unproductive and unethical. More big twists and turns in the economy and markets. 1987 and 1988 were filled with more of those big twists and turns that helped shape me and my approach to life and investing. We were one of the few investment managers who were short stocks ahead of Black Monday, October 19, 1987, then the largest single day percentage decline in the history of the stock market. We got a lot of attention because we were up 22% when most others were down a lot. The media dubbed us as among the heroes of October. Naturally, I was feeling pretty good going into 1988. I had grown up in an era of high volatility and had learned that the best way to play it is to get a hold of a big move and ride it. We used our indicators to catch shifting fundamentals and our technical trend-following filters to confirm that the price movements were consistent with what the indicators were suggesting. When they both pointed in the same direction, we had a strong signal. When they were at odds, we had little or no signal. But as it turned out, there was hardly any volatility in 1988, so our technical filters whipsawed us, and we ended up giving back a bit more than half of our 1987 gains. That stung, but it also taught us some important lessons and prompted Bob and me to replace our technical trend-following filter with better value measures and risk controls. Until then, our systems had been completely discrete. In other words, they would flip from a fully long position to a fully short position when we crossed a predetermined threshold, much as we switched from bonds to cash for the World Bank. But we weren't always equally confident in our views, and we'd also get killed paying transaction costs when we crossed back and forth a lot. That drove Bob crazy. I can remember him running laps around the office building to calm himself down. So, at the end of the year, we moved to a more variable system that allowed us to size our bets in relationship to how confident we were. These and other improvements Bob made to our systems have paid off many times since. Not everyone at Bridgewater saw things as Bob and I did. Some of the company doubted that systemization could work, especially when the systems didn't do well, which, like normal decision-making, happened every now and then. It took a lot of reasoning to persuade some of the people I worked with to press on. But even if I couldn't convince them, they couldn't change my mind because they couldn't show me any good reason our approach of clearly specifying, testing, and systemizing our logic wasn't preferable to making decisions less systematically. All great investors and investment approaches have bad patches. Losing faith in them at such times is as common a mistake as getting too enamored with them when they do well. Because most people are more emotional than logical, they tend to overreact to short-term results. They give up and sell low when times are bad, and buy too high when times are good. I find this is just as true for relationships as it is for investments. Wise people stick with sound fundamentals through the ups and downs, while flighty people react emotionally to how things feel, jumping into things when they're hot and abandoning them when they're not. Despite our relatively poor investment performance, 1988 was a great year for Bridgewater because by reflecting on and learning from our poor performance, we made systematic improvements. I've come to realize that bad times coupled with good reflections provide some of the best lessons, and not just about business, but also about relationships. One has many more supposed friends when one is up than when one is down, because most people like to be with winners and shun losers. True friends are the opposite. I got a lot out of the bad times, not just because they gave me mistakes to learn from, but also because they helped me find out who my real friends were, the friends who would be with me through thick and thin. The next foothold for Bridgewater. As the 1980s came to an end, we were still a very small company with just 24 employees. Bob introduced me to Giselle Wagner in 1988. She would be my partner in running the non-investment side of the business for 20 years. Dan Bernstein and Ross Waller joined in 1988 and 1989 respectively, both fresh out of Dartmouth College. At the time, and for quite a while longer, I tended to hire people just out of school who didn't have much experience, but were smart, determined, and committed to the mission of making the company great. I didn't value experience as much as I valued character, creativity, and common sense, which I suppose was related to my having started Bridgewater 2 years out of school myself, and my belief that having an ability to figure things out is more important than having specific knowledge of how to do something. It seemed to me young people were creating sensible innovation that was exciting. Older folks who did things in the old ways held no appeal to me. I should add, though, that putting responsibility in the hands of inexperienced people doesn't always work out so well. Some painful lessons that you'll hear about later taught me that it could be a mistake to undervalue experience. By now, the initial $5 million from the World Bank had grown to $180 million in investments that we were managing for a variety of clients, but we were still trying to grab a larger foothold in the institutional investment business. When Rusty Olson, the chief investment officer of Kodak's pension fund, approached us to solve an investment problem, we jumped on the chance. Rusty was a remarkable innovator and a man of great character who started at Kodak in 1954 and took over the pension fund in 1972. He was widely respected as a leader in the pension fund world. We had been sending him our research for a while, and in 1990 he wrote us looking for an opinion on a big concern of his. The Kodak portfolio was heavily invested in equities, and Rusty was worried about what would happen in an environment in which the value of his assets fell badly. He had been trying to come up with a way to hedge himself against this risk without reducing his expected return. Rusty's fax arrived on Friday afternoon, and we leapt into action. Getting a client this prestigious and innovative would make a big difference to us. We knew we could do a uniquely great job for Kodak because we knew a lot about bonds and financial engineering, and we had a historical perspective unmatched in the industry. Bob Prince, Dan Bernstein, and I worked nonstop through the weekend, analyzing the Kodak portfolio and the strategy Rusty was considering. Then we wrote him a long memo laying out our thoughts. Just as I had deconstructed the business of a chicken producer in the 1970s, and many other companies since, we broke down Kodak's pension fund into its constituent parts to better understand the machine. Our proposed solutions drew on the portfolio engineering ideas that would later become core to Bridgewater's unique way of managing money. Rusty invited Bob and me to Rochester, and we came home with the $100 million account. That was a game changer. Not only did it bring us a lot of credibility, it provided us with a reliable source of revenue at a time we needed it. Discovering the Holy Grail of Investing. From my earlier failures, I knew that no matter how confident I was in making any one bet, I could still be wrong, and that diversification was the key to reducing risks without reducing returns. If I could build a portfolio filled with high-quality return streams that were properly diversified, in other words, they zigged and zagged in ways that balanced each other out, I could offer clients an overall portfolio return which was much more consistent and reliable than they would get elsewhere. Decades earlier, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Harry Markowitz had invented a widely used model that allowed one to input a set of assets with fair expected returns, risks, and correlations, and determine an optimal mix of those assets in a portfolio. But his model didn't tell you anything about the incremental effects of changing any one of those variables, or how to handle being uncertain about those assumptions. By then, I was terribly fearful about what would happen if my assumptions were wrong, so I wanted to understand diversification in a very simple way. I asked Brian Gold, a recently graduated math major from Dartmouth who joined Bridgewater in 1990, to do a chart showing how the volatility of a portfolio would decline and its quality, as measured by the amount of return relative to the risk it would have, would improve if I incrementally added investments with different correlations. I'll explain all that in more detail in my economic and investment principles. That simple chart struck me with the same force I imagine Einstein must have felt when he discovered E equals mc squared. I saw that with 15 to 20 good, uncorrelated return streams, I could dramatically reduce my risks without reducing my expected returns. It was so simple, but it would be such a breakthrough if the theory worked as well in practice as it did on paper. I called it the Holy Grail of investing because it showed the path to making a fortune. This was another key moment in our education. The principle we discovered applies equally well to all ways of trying to make money. When you own a hotel, run a technology company, or do anything, your business produces a return stream. Having a few good, uncorrelated return streams is better than having just one, and knowing how to combine return streams is even more effective than being able to choose good ones, though of course you have to do both. At the time, and still today, most investment managers didn't take advantage of this. They managed investments in a single asset class. Equity managers managed equities, bond managers managed bonds, and so on. Their clients gave them money with the expectation that they would receive the overall return of that asset class, such as the S&P stock market price index, plus some added returns from the bets the managers took to overweigh or underweigh particular assets, such as buying more of Microsoft stock rather than the index and less of something else. But individual assets within an asset class are generally about 60% correlated with each other, which means they go up or down together more than half the time. As the Holy Grail concept conveyed, an equity manager could put 1,000 60% correlated stocks into their portfolio, and it wouldn't provide much more diversification if they picked only 5. It would be easy to beat those guys by balancing our bets in the way the chart indicated. Thanks to my process of systematically recording my investment principles and the results they could be expected to produce, I had a large collection of uncorrelated return streams. In fact, I had something like 1,000 of them. Because we traded a number of different asset classes, and within each one we had programmed and tested a lot of fundamental trading rules, we had many more high-quality ones to choose from than a typical manager who was tracking a smaller number of assets and was probably not trading systematically. I worked with Bob and Dan to pull our best decision rules from the pile. Once we had them, we back-tested them over long time frames, using the systems to simulate how the decision rules would have worked together in the past. We were startled by the results. On paper, this new approach improved our returns by a factor of 3 to 5 times per unit of risk, and we could calibrate the amount of return we wanted based on the amount of risk we could tolerate. In other words, we could make a ton more money than the other guys with lower risk of being knocked out of the game, as I'd nearly been before. I called it the killer system because it would either produce killer results for us and our clients, or it would kill us because we were missing something important. The success of this approach taught me a principle that I apply to all parts of my life. Making a handful of good uncorrelated bets that are balanced and leveraged well is the surest way of having a lot of upside without being exposed to unacceptable downside. As excited as we were about this new approach, we proceeded cautiously. We gave the system a 10% weight initially, and it made money in 19 of 20 months in our test period. As we got more confident, I decided to reach out to a select group of investors I knew about investing in a strategy with just $1 million trial accounts. I knew that asking these institutional investors to invest such a relatively modest amount would make it hard for them to turn us down. I called the new product Top 5% at first, because it comprised the best 5% of our decision rules. Later, I changed the name to Pure Alpha to convey that it consisted purely of alphas. Because Pure Alpha didn't have any betas, it didn't have any biases to go up or down with any market. Its returns depended only on how good we were at outperforming others. Our totally new alpha overlay approach allowed investors to receive the return of their chosen asset class. For example, the S&P stock market, a bond index, commodities, whatever. Plus the return the portfolio of the bets were making across all asset classes. As unprecedented as our approach was, we explained the logic carefully, showing why it actually made so much more sense than traditional investment approaches. We also showed them how we expected the cumulative performance to unfold and what the expected range of performance around that would be. For our clients, it was a bit like being presented with the design of a plane that had never flown before, but looked radically better than other planes on paper. Would anyone be courageous enough to get on board? Some clients got the concepts and were excited to change the rules. Others didn't understand or worked for organizations that refused to try cutting-edge new things. Frankly, we were thrilled that any of them were willing to try. For over 26 years now, that new type of plane has flown exactly as we anticipated, making money in 23 of these years and having only 3 years of modest losses, making more money in total for our clients than any other hedge fund ever. While the investment management concepts that underlie Pure Alpha eventually changed our industry, the journey from conception to general acceptance took many years of learning and grinding work by a group of dedicated partners. Getting our killer system out into the world. Pure Alpha represented the best way we knew to actively manage money. But we also knew that if we wanted to manage a meaningful amount of institutional money, we had to accept the reality that only a limited number of innovative clients would try this approach. So while we tried to convince clients to adopt our way, by the end of the 1990s and into the early 2000s, Pure Alpha made up only about 10% of our total assets under management. Even though we couldn't trade stocks and commodities in our pure bond accounts, we applied the portfolio structuring principles we discovered and used with Pure Alpha to give our bond clients higher returns at lower risks. This included trading foreign government bonds, emerging market debt, inflation-linked bonds, corporate bonds, and the currency exposures that came with the foreign investments. In our most unconstrained portfolios, we would make about 50 different types of bets, way more than traditional bond managers traded. Doing so gave us a big edge and landed us at the top of many investment performance tables year after year. Our Pure Alpha product was just the first of a number of innovative designs we brought to our clients. In 1991, we had become the first currency overlay manager for institutional investors. At the time, institutional investors were placing large portions of their portfolios into global equity and bond markets. While investing internationally added valuable diversity, it also added unmanaged currency exposure. This was a big problem because the currency exposures added risks without adding any expected return. We had traded currencies for years and had developed expertise in portfolio engineering, so we were in a prime position to solve this problem for them. Eventually, we became the largest active currency manager in the world. We also produced several other new and effective ways of managing money that flew exactly as they were designed. With each one, we gave clients clearly stated performance expectations expressed in a chart that showed an accumulated profit line and the expected variations around that line. We could do this because the systemization of our decision-making process allowed us to stress test the performance of our decision-making under a wide range of conditions. systemizing our learning from mistakes. Of course we continued to make mistakes, though they were all within our range of expectations. What was great is that we made the most of our mistakes, because we got in the habit of viewing them as opportunities to learn and improve. One of the most memorable mistakes happened in the early 1990s when